They try to tell us we're too young.
Young people can't find work.
I wish I were big.
If you thought unemployment was high, try it as a 20-something.
Now what?
You get a job.
Cannot get a job.
Wasn't youth a plus at some point?
We were not too young at all.
Lying about your age to get a job, but the other way around on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, October 13th. I'm Celeste Headlee. John Hockenberry is away for a few days. Coming up this hour, we're going to talk about jobs. It is tough to get a job out there. It's especially tough if you just graduated from college or high school. We're going to hear about that in just a few minutes. Also, Hillary Clinton is in Russia. She's meeting there with Dmitry Medvedev. We're going to get the lowdown on what they're discussing. But first, Harvey Cummins is 25 years old. He's from Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning, Harvey. So you got laid off from your teacher as a middle school band teacher. Do you think that happened because of your age?
That's the million-dollar question. I mean, it was either my age or my experience, because I was a first-year teacher.
What makes you think it could have been because you were in your, you know, early 20s?
I mean, well, most of the other teachers there were in their, like, late 40s or, you know, like, going, like, in their 50s, and I was, like, one of the youngest teachers there, and I don't know, like, the students felt comfortable with me, I guess, being young, and I really don't know, but I mean, I think that really had something to do with it.
Stay with us, Harvey Cummins. We're going to be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything else that you need to know this morning. In the headlines, the Senate Finance Committee votes on its health care plan today. Democrats control the committee, so it's probably going to pass. But they're also hoping to get that crucial vote from Republican Senator Olympia Snowe. Overseas, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Moscow right now. She's been discussing Iran with the president. Both Russia and the U.S. have pledged to work together to ensure that Iran's nuclear program is meant for peaceful purposes. Staying abroad, Pakistan launched an airstrike today along the country's main insurgent stronghold near the Afghan border. The country's military has talked of a new offensive against insurgents. This could be a precursor to that. Meanwhile, the U.S. Treasury says al-Qaeda is facing a funding crisis. Officials say the influence of the organization is declining, but the Taliban are in much better financial shape. An unusually strong fall storm is headed for California. That's causing residents in areas hit by recent wildfires to prepare for possible mudslides caused by heavy rain. Wall Street's mostly flat yesterday. The Dow starts trade today at 98.86. The S&P kicks off at 10.76, and the Nasdaq's going to open up at 20.39. And we're asking you this morning, how has age affected your job hunt? Has it hurt you or helped you?
Rick Austin from New Jersey. My wife graduated college with a teaching degree 4 years ago. It was her tenure year last year. She didn't get tenure. They replaced a non-tenured teachers with first-year level teachers so that they can pay them on a first-year level rather than the third or fourth-year level.
What are you seeing out there? Are the young and the old suffering in a much worse proportion to the others? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee. John Hockenberry is away for a few days. So as of September, less than half of people aged 16 to 24 had jobs. That's the lowest rate since 1948, which is actually when the government started counting. But at the same time, older workers are also finding it very difficult to find work, and age discrimination claims are up 29%. So we're asking you today, how has your age helped you or hurt you in the job market? Tell us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're joined again by Harvey Cummins. He was laid off from his job as a middle school band teacher in June, and he joins us from Charlotte, North Carolina. And of course, our friend and Takeaway contributor, Beth Kobliner, author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. Beth joins us every week to talk about work. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
So we have new research out showing 46% of kids, people between 16 and 24
right.
are now employed. Is that because more people are in school? What's causing this low rate?
Well, there's a lot of factors trickling into this, but one of the main ones is because of the bad economy, you're seeing a whole sort of food chain of joblessness happen, where people who are teenagers now who are getting certain jobs, entry-level jobs, we saw it a lot during the summer, where they would maybe enter into a entry-level job, which is now being taken by a college graduate, and or perhaps a retiree who's returning to work because he lost his pension or she lost her home's value that she was hoping to retire on. And that 60-plus-year-old is now in that job. So we're seeing major devastation, particularly in inner-city areas, where joblessness is as high as 70, 80, even 90% in some inner cities.
Among these younger people. Now, one of the reports that we'd heard actually, I think it was maybe 9 months ago, was they were actually worried about young people taking jobs from, say, the middle-aged or the older workers, because the young people were willing to accept the lower wage. That's turned out to not be true?
Not the case. You know, what we saw for older people, we've seen, first of all, there's been a lot of attention now to the fact that older people in this recession have been the ones who have been laid off predominantly, because they're the ones who have been earning that higher wage. And so we're also seeing a rise in discrimination, age discrimination lawsuits, because, you know, is it discrimination or is it that because they're earning a higher wage, they're the first to go? So there's a lot of complexity involved. And I think really what we're seeing, you know, for the first time, there are four generations in the workplace vying for that same limited pool of jobs. We have Generation Y, we have Generation X, we have the boomers, and then now the matures, age 63 and over. This group, which probably would have been retired a few decades ago, but they are staying in the workplace because they have to. And I think that's the battle that's been going on. And the younger people, that 16 to 20-year-old, 24-year-old group, they're being hit incredibly hard, harder than ever before.
Well, this is what we heard from 24-year-old Joseph Wright. He graduated this May with a master's in accounting, and he as of yet, has not had a full-time job.
I've been searching for a job ever since I graduated. I ended up not doing an internship over the summer because I went to summer school to catch up. And, you know, I had some advice from people saying that wasn't a big deal, and now not having an internship, everyone looks at it, and I don't really have much job experience.
So, Harvey Cummings, you're 25. You were laid off from your job as a middle school band teacher this summer and did not return for the school year this fall. You must recognize something of what Joseph Wright was saying there, that you feel like you probably lost your job because of job experience, right?
Yeah.
So you must be concerned. I mean, as you're looking for a job, it's probably also hindering you that, A, you know, you're young, and you also still are lacking job experience, right?
That's correct. I guess the only thing that I have at my advantage is I'm still finishing grad school.
Mm. And a lot of young people are doing just that. They're going back to school. They're trying to figure out, how do you buy time? You know, we're seeing a huge increase in Peace Corps, huge increase in Teach for America, all these great organizations, but a lot of young people are just sort of stuck because they can't get a job. And we're seeing it across the board. You know, we're seeing Ivy League kids, they're not getting those, certainly, investment banking jobs because they don't exist anymore in many cases. And we're seeing, you know, it really, you know, African-American young people, young males, age 20 to 24, the unemployment rate right now is 27%.
Wow.
Whereas the unemployment
27%.
Rate... 27%. For young people, 20 to 24 in general, it's 15%. Whereas compared to the national unemployment rate, it's about 10%, 9.5%.
Well, Beth, we are already getting responses from listeners. You can call in with your story at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytakeofthetakeaway.org. Here's what one listener had to say.
Dan Schaubel from Boston, Massachusetts. Age is a huge factor right now in recruitment. There are 6.3 applicants for every one job now, and so experienced workers have a huge advantage over someone who's just graduated from college, someone who's young, because they have more experience and they're seen as higher value, and companies know that they can get them at a cheaper price.
So is that what's causing the problem? I mean, 27% of unemployment among 20 to 24-year-olds, that's more than a quarter of the population. That seems huge.
Right. I think that, you know, it certainly is huge. And I think because of these complex factors, but again, older workers too are having a difficult time, and that they're being left out because they're earning, because so the young people can't even get a foothold in the job market to begin with, and the older people are losing jobs because they're the on the higher end of the spectrum when it comes to pay, and therefore the tensions are high, and I think that's the interesting thing that we're seeing.
And we're joined now by Jackie Goldenberg. She's 65. She was laid off from the financial services industry 2 years ago. Jackie, she joins us from New York.
Hi.
So you're hearing this sort of, I guess, donut hole in the middle of the employment, with it, which is that the front and the back end are empty, and then we've got the middle all filled in. You were laid off 2 years ago. Have you been looking for work that whole time?
I have, yes. I have been looking for work that whole time. I will tell you, though, that where I was working, which was at a huge bank, the donut hole was much larger than, you know, I mean, actually much smaller, because the donut hole would start at about age 42 or so. You know, I think people in their early 40s mm-hmm. would start knowing or being, you know, anticipating that they could lose their jobs.
Do you think that you were laid off because of your age?
Yes, I have no doubt about it.
Why not? How do you know?
Well, I know because, first of all, I got hired at the bank when I was 56, which was pretty extraordinary, and I worked there for 7 years, and I did survive earlier downsizing. So a lot of people were fired, but pretty much anybody over 50, you would feel that you were the most vulnerable, both in the bank and on your team, and I was by far the oldest person on my team. I mean, actually, my boss was only about 10 years younger. I mean, I had bosses or colleagues that were, you know, 30 years younger often.
Wow.
And, the atmosphere there was, you know, I sat with much younger people. I mean, we didn't sit with our teams because there was so much downsizing and merging and all that going on. And pretty much everybody around me was much, you know, significantly younger.
Well, we spoke to a recruiter named Rachel Rabinowitz. She's out of Atlanta, Georgia, yesterday, and we asked her what she's been seeing in terms of who's hiring who.
The struggles that the younger generation are finding is that they have no experience, and the employers are not wanting to invest the training and time into the younger employees. And for the older generation, the employer's slant usually is that they think maybe they only have another 5 years left and that they won't give it their all.
Beth, is this part of the problem? They don't want to invest in the younger employees, and in the older employees, they figure they're only there for a few years?
I think that's part of it. I think also we're seeing, again, in the workplace, once they are a mix of generations, we're seeing this this communication gap in that one poll last year found that older workers are feeling disenfranchised. In some ways, they find younger people can be impatient with them and don't make eye contact in the way that they're used to, or are Twittering or are text messaging during presentations. So I think we're seeing a whole bunch of communication issues that will need to be addressed as we go forward. And as the economy does improve and as we start seeing more hiring take place, how people are going to communicate, because it is an unusual experience having this many different generations at either end of the spectrum in the workplace.
And I imagine this is going to cause problems in the future, because what we're going to end up with is a huge number of people who don't have any job experience at all when they're getting into their late 20s and on towards 30, and they're not paying into either the income taxes or Social Security.
That's right.
Beth Koblenner is our takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. We are also joined by Harvey Cummings, who was laid off from his job as a middle school teacher, and 65-year-old Jackie Goldenberg, still looking for work in the financial services industry in New York. So we're asking you to tell us your story about how age has either helped you or hurt you as you're looking for a job. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now, some quick takeouts on stories we're following all this week. We're going to go to Capitol Hill first. Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is out this whole week, and filling in is our good friend Julie Mason. She's the White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. So, Julie, today is the day. The Senate Finance Committee is voting on that bill today. It's going to pass, most likely. But obviously there's a question of whether Olympia Snow is going to vote for it or not, which would mean something, I guess, according to how the bill will pass in the full Senate. But we're also going to talk about this report coming out of the American Health Industry plans. They have are blanketing the TV with ads about these reports that they've come up with on the costs. What have they supposedly found, and who are they trying to reach here?
Well, the timing is very key with this report. It's a trade group, and they're claiming that what's being proposed in Congress right now would raise everybody's rates like crazy, and it would just pass all incredibly high costs onto the consumers. And so they're trying to stir up some controversy ahead of this debate. And as these bills get ready to hit the House and Senate floor, they're not going to influence the Senate committee vote today. They're looking down the road. They want people to get upset and excited and call their congressman or congresswoman and say, "Don't vote for this. This is a terrible measure." And that's what they're hoping to
do. But this is basically numbers coming from the health insurance industry.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Right. And the White House was so exercised about this yesterday. They were calling it a distortion and saying it was flawed, and they were very upset about it. But in this debate, consumers aren't really sure who to listen to. And if they're happy with their insurers and their insurers are saying this is a bad bill, well, that's going to be a voice they listen to, even though they may know on some level that these industries are very self-serving.
So here is the director of the White House Office of Health Reform.
I think, though, that maybe they've gotten worried as we get close to really getting reform done. They've gotten more worried about their profits.
As you said, the reaction from the White House was swift and strong.
Well, the White House really thought that they had brought the industry along. They wanted to avoid the mistakes of the Clinton administration and make sure that they had all aspects of industry on board with this so there wouldn't be any of these final hour mutinies. And so when this did come up over the weekend and yesterday, the White House was sort of acting like a spurned boyfriend. You know, like, hey, I thought you were with me and now you don't like me anymore. And oh, so it's kind of funny to watch them in a tailspin.
Well, I don't think it's going to, as you say, it's probably not going to affect the vote from the Senate Finance Committee at all today. Julie Mason, thanks so much. She's a White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. We're going to move on to business now with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. So, Louise, a big trial coming up. This is the first one. This trial dates back to the two Bear Stearns hedge funds that failed in 2007. And some people say that was the beginning of the whole economic meltdown, right? So what is this case about?
Morning, Celeste. This case is huge because we really haven't seen any Wall Street guys in handcuffs. And, you know, there's a lot of anger out there, a lot of feeling that Wall Street misled us all about what they were doing in the mortgage market. These two hedge funds at Bear Stearns specialized in mortgage bonds, and they owned a ton of the subprime mortgage bonds. So they're on trial for telling their investors that their hedge funds were doing just fine, even as they were writing emails to each other with their fears. Listen to this one. In April of 2007, one of the guys, Matt Tannen, went on his personal Gmail and he wrote the other leader of the hedge fund, Ralph Chaffee. He said, "The entire subprime market is toast." And then a few days later, he told his investors in a conference call, "We're very comfortable with exactly where we are."
Oh, wow.
So these emails are kind of damning.
I bet so. So, I mean, obviously they're going to be able to enter these emails into evidence showing a clear disparity between what they were telling the investors and what they were saying to each other. This is the first trial, as we said. Are we going to see some more people getting charged?
There are a lot of investigations going on. There haven't been so many indictments. If you don't have juicy emails like that, you know, not everyone writes that kind of stuff in their Gmail. If you don't have that kind of email trail, it's a lot harder to prove these cases. It's a lot harder to prove that people knew something they weren't telling their investors. But, you know, one thing we've been talking about on the show a lot is this case against Bank of America about losses at Merrill Lynch. And that centers on the same issue. And that issue is, what do you have to tell your shareholders or what do you have to tell your investors? If you're worried about something, do you need to tell them? And this Bear Stearns hedge fund case is right around that. It's about how positive can you be and when is optimism actually a lie? So it'll be very interesting to watch.
Okay, and I would imagine there's a lot of people that didn't realize that their personal Gmail accounts could be subpoenaed and they're I guess, maybe frantically going through their archives to see what they wrote. Thanks so much. That's Louise Story. She's the finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. And now on to sports. It's time to play Tuesday Morning Quarterback with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
So, Monday Night Football, Miami Dolphins, the New York Jets. The Jets,
who have the best rushing attack and best rushing defense in the league,
right?
Went up against the best rushing attack, and basically the Dolphins ran well, but they threw the ball better. They brought in young Chad Henne, who was 20 for 26 with 241 yards and 2 touchdowns. A couple takeouts in this game.
It was a squeaker. First of all, Miami only won 31-27.
Precisely, and it was 5 touchdowns in the fourth quarter. That means that the lead changed more times than in any recent memory with a Monday Night Football game. But there was the most important part of this game, there was no turnovers. This was mistake-proof football. It was excellent football. It was the best kind of football that you want to see with 2 young quarterbacks playing and 2 excellent defenses. It was a really beautiful game.
So maybe it was just showing that maybe the best defense and the best rushing, which one wins? I mean, maybe that settled that argument.
And in the very end, the Wildcat formation, which Miami uses, which is a very difficult formation for defenses because it tightens up the defense. It tightens up the offense. So a defense like the Jets has less lanes to run into. So with 10 seconds left on the goal line, Miami going in, the Jets trying to stop them, 3rd and inches, boom, the Wildcat offense pushes through, and that was the end of the game in Miami. It was really exciting.
Okay, so now on to Major League Baseball. It was like 40 degrees in Denver. You think that would play to the Rockies' strengths. They're used to that kind of weather, but they went up against the Phillies, and the Phillies beat them 5-4.
Exactly, and the story of this one is not that Cliff Lee pitched amazing, because he did. It's not that Howard hit an amazing hit in the ninth inning, and not that they even scored 3 runs in the ninth. It was all about Brad Lidge, who everyone was worried about as a closer, who everyone was like, oh no, the Phillies aren't going to do well. Brad Lidge has come through, and now the Phillies are legitimate. They play now again, as they did last year, the Los Angeles Dodgers in the National League Championship Series,
on
the NLCS,
Thursday. Exactly,
on Thursday. And so that's going to be a great
rematch.
Who are
you predicting?
This is the thing. I think that because Brad Lidge is back, in terms of closing with authority, I think the Phillies have the edge
in
this one.
If he can sustain it.
Correct.
And we've also got the Los Angeles Angels. They're going to play New York, the Yankees,
who you
on
don't
Friday.
Like. No. So
I like the Angels fine. I'm going to predict the Angels. Are you predicting the Yankees?
Listen, this is the thing. This is a year of amazing things happening, and the Yankees are going to slay the ghost of their Angels, with the Angels. They're going to beat the Angels.
Okay, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our Takeaway Sports contributor. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
Coming up, we'll follow Hillary Clinton to Russia, and we'll answer the all-important question, why a statue of Walt Whitman at Moscow State University? That's in just a moment. But first, Mark Garrison has some of the news stories that we're following at 32 minutes past the hour.
Thank you, Celeste. Some business news just in a couple minutes ago. The CEO of lender CIT is resigning. The troubled company has been trying to restructure and stay out of bankruptcy. Today in Washington, the Senate Finance Committee votes on its $829 billion health care plan. Democrats are in power, so it will pass. The suspense is over whether Republican Senator Olympia Snow will back the plan. We'll see. The committee meets in about 90 minutes. As Celeste mentioned, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Russia right now. In about half an hour, she meets with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. And the Treasury Department says al-Qaeda is running low on money. Treasury works to block terror finance, but it also reports the Taliban are now well-funded with drug profits from Afghanistan. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So as we've been mentioning all morning, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Russia today. She's meeting with President Dmitry Medvedev.
We are different countries. We have different historical experiences, different perspectives. But we are planting those disagreements in a much, broader field of cooperation.
And that broad field of cooperation includes a lot of things. The U.S. is hoping to work together with Russia on everything from Iran to nuclear disarmament and probably the war in Afghanistan as well. So Masha Lipman is joining us to talk about the sense of what the Russians feel about Clinton's visit. She's a researcher and journalist with the Carnegie Moscow Center. Good morning, Masha.
Good morning.
So first of all, let's talk about the reaction to Hillary Clinton in Russia. Is she a popular figure there?
Not too much. I think to begin with, she, of course, is associated with her husband and his presidency, which is regarded in Russia as a time when America took advantage of Russia and did not reckon with it. The presidency of Bill Clinton is not regarded in Russia as a time when the relations were good. Also, that was the time of the presidency of President Yeltsin in Russia, who, too, is regarded as a figure who did more harm to Russia than good. So this makes her a person from those days.
So, I mean, there's a lot of topics she's talking about with the president there. I mean, let's start first with Iran. Obviously, the United States is hoping to get Russia on board in the effort to discourage Iran's nuclear ambitions. And they're hoping Russia is going to increase pressure on Iran. What are the chances that she's going to succeed in that?
Well, actually, the chance is just slightly better now than it used to be, especially after Obama announced that he would scrap the plan to deploy elements of the American anti-missile defense in Central Europe. This development was regarded with pleasure in Russia, and hence President Medvedev's statement not a very long time ago that sometimes sanctions can be sensible. This is still far from a pledge, a commitment to come on board with the United States in the sanctions against Iran, but this sounds more compliant with that idea. I would still caution against assuming that from here we leap towards sanctions. I think we need to wait until Russia indeed joins the sanctions. I think these statements will not have much weight.
How are the people in Russia feeling about the situation with Iran? Are they also cautious about using sanctions against Tehran?
Well, I think the issue of Iran in Russia is viewed through the lens of U.S.-American relations. And over the years of President Bush's presidency especially, the anti-American sentiments have been truly strong, have grown a lot stronger than before, not least thanks to government propaganda. But this is also, I think, how people genuinely feel. And so whatever America wants Russia to do, to join, to come on board on, is treated with suspicion as a desire to somehow weaken Russia, do harm to Russia. There should be some ulterior motive. And just because the U.S. wants Russia to come on board, I think many people in Russia would believe that this is a perfect reason for Russia not to join.
Well, obviously, famously, George W. Bush said that he looked into Putin's eyes and they understood one another. But there certainly does seem to be a change in sentiment towards this American president. President Obama seems to be viewed a lot more favorably in Russia, and I assume that's because of his stance, as you said, on arms control. Is President Obama, does he have more political capital there because of his stance on arms control?
I would say first and foremost, it is important what the two most powerful men in Russia believe, and this is Prime Minister, formerly President Putin, who still remains the number one most powerful person in the country, and President Medvedev, not what the Russian people would think. And I think the decision to scrap the American plan to deploy elements of anti-missile defense in the Czech Republic and Poland was taken favorably in Russia and was appreciated. Does this mean that Russia will now be compliant, that Russia will come on board, that Russia will make firm commitments, something that Russia has avoided, has generally avoided doing as far as U.S.-American relations are concerned? This still remains to be seen.
I have to imagine that there's some kind of perspective on Afghanistan and Russia that we do not have the United States because of the Russian involvement, because of the Russian tragedies in Afghanistan. And obviously, as a member of NATO, Hillary Clinton has to be going there to talk about how the NATO troops are going to be deployed, whether we're going to be sending more troops there. And I'm wondering, what do you think President Medvedev is going to say to her? Is he going to have any advice for Hillary Clinton about the situation in Afghanistan?
Most importantly on the issue of Afghanistan is that this is the one area in which there has been new cooperation. Just prior to President Obama's visit to Moscow in summer, Russia made a pledge in a very rare instance that it will expand the permission to use the Russian airspace for deliveries, for military deliveries to Afghanistan. And this is an important development. It may be argued that Russia itself benefits from it because because Afghanistan and should the situation there really unravel is presents a danger to the Russian security, Russia being much closer to Afghanistan than the United States. And yet, I think it is interesting that this is a recent development and this is a definitive, quite substantial, tangible thing that that Russia pledged to do. So I think there is potentially there may be an opportunity for further expansion of deliveries, and maybe this will be discussed between Hillary Clinton and President Medvedev.
So, Masha Litman, you're a political analyst with the Carnegie Moscow Center. I can't let you go away. You went to school at Moscow State University, and I can't let you leave without quickly asking you why there's a statue of Walt Whitman going up at Moscow State University.
Beats me, really. This is really ironic. Why, of all people, of all poets, of all American poets, they picked Walt Whitman, who is known to be gay, in the city of Moscow, which is ruled by the Moscow mayor, who is notoriously anti-gay. We're not talking homophobic here. We're talking about he really speaks in a very ugly fashion about gay people, calling their groups satanic gatherings.
It's a mystery,
calling
isn't it?
Them weapons of mass destruction.
Okay.
And he should be even present at the ceremony of the inauguration of the statue with Hillary Clinton.
Masha Litman, thanks, political analyst at the Carnegie Moscow Center. She was joining us from Moscow. Coming up, we're going to get an on-the-ground look at the fighting in Afghanistan. We preview the new Frontline documentary that's premiering tonight called Obama's War. That's later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
It's not that easy being green. Having to spend each day the color of the leaves.
Well, I can't speak to the challenges of being a frog, but it's a lot easier to be green today by about $1 billion anyway. George Soros is the 29th richest man in the world, and he has promised to invest $1 billion in clean energy technology. Joining us with more details on this is Stacey Palmer. She's the editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. She joins us from her home in Washington. Good morning, Stacey.
Hello, happy to be with you.
So beyond just the total of $1 billion, what has George Soros promised?
The other thing he's promised is to put $100 million into an environmental group that's going to help make sure that environmental policy is something that's very important. So he's set up a group that's going to be help shape policy, play watchdog role, really try to advance policies to prevent environmental trouble. And so that's an important piece that comes along with this. He said, I'm investing the money in for-profit businesses, but I'm also doing things that only a nonprofit organization can probably do in this area that's so contentious.
Has he chosen specific industries, wind power, solar power, are things that he's particularly pointed to that he wants to put his money towards?
He wasn't very specific in terms of what kinds of things the $1 billion in the for-profit would go to, just things that generally would help solve the problem of global warming. So he's very specific on that, but not on the kinds of things he's going to do. And I expect more details will be forthcoming. But he talked a little bit about what it was that he wanted this policymaking group to do. And he recognized that it's important to have somebody promoting the idea of green technology, standing in for the public interest, because certainly these investments, they're going to be focused on making a profit as well as protecting the public. And he recognized that you have to do one thing and the other at the same time. So that's kind of an interesting thing. You don't often see philanthropy coupling a business investment and a nonprofit investment.
So very often in the philanthropic world anyway, where George Soros goes, much of the other charitable dollars go as well. What makes this particular $1 billion important, though?
It's important for a number of reasons. First of all, it's new that Soros is getting involved in technology and solving problems like this on the environment. He usually focuses on things like, you know, promoting a free press, improving education, improving health. So this
political
is
campaigns too, yeah.
A different kind of thing for him. So I think, you know, it's signaling a new area that he thinks that other philanthropists might be interested in. It's also a significant amount of money. To give $100 million, not very many philanthropists have been doing that in this recession. There have only been two gifts so far this year of that much money. And typically by this time in the year, we see at least 20 gifts of that size. So I think he's also saying it's time for philanthropists to start putting their money out, that although a lot of them lost money, it's time to invest in things. Many of them still have significant reserves that they can give away. So I think he's also saying it's time to put your passions to work.
Very quickly, can we expect other philanthropists to follow suit?
Absolutely. absolutely. A lot of foundations have gotten very interested in the environment in the last few years, so I think much more is going to come this way.
Okay, Stacey Palmer is the editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. She joined us from Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for speaking with us. Just a reminder, we are asking you for your personal story. Certainly, if you have a personal story about giving away $1 billion to green technology, give us a call. But we're asking you how your age has affected your job search. If you're looking for work or if you're currently employed, if you are young or old, how has your age affected your employment? Give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee, going it alone for a few days while John Hockenberry is away. Coming up, we're going to get a preview of a new Frontline documentary that airs tonight on PBS stations, a very up-close view of the soldiers in Afghanistan. More on that in a moment. But we're also talking today about young and old and their troubles in finding jobs. And we want you to tell us your story. Has your age ever hurt or helped you in getting a job?
I think the people that are graduating with degrees in the creative sector are actually seeing the flip side of this. They're more familiar with the more cutting-edge versions of software, interactive media for web design, advertising design, and industrial design. And they're finding that they're more in demand when they're actually getting out of college.
Tell us your story on 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, here's Mark Garrison. He's got to check on the leading news stories at 48 minutes past the hour.
Thank you, Celeste. The Senate Finance Committee votes on its health care overhaul today. Democrats have the votes to move it through to the full Senate. The thing to watch is whether Republican Senator Olympia Snow will back the plan. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Russia right now. She's stressing cooperation on a number of issues, including arms control and Iran's nuclear program. Clinton's talking about moving past Cold War thinking.
We are transforming a relationship that was once defined by the shadow of mutually assured destruction into one that is based on mutual respect.
Clinton meets with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev in a few minutes. In New York, the fraud trial begins today for two former managers from investment bank Bear Stearns. They're accused of knowing about problems with hedge funds that collapsed in 2007, but failing to inform investors they could face decades in prison if found guilty. The Washington Post reports the White House has authorized deploying some 13,000 support troops to Afghanistan. To be clear, these are support troops. This is not tied to the big decision coming, or expected at least, from President Obama on new forces requested by General Stanley McChrystal. Looking ahead to later this week, baseball's league championships are now set. The Philadelphia Phillies won last night, so they'll face the Los Angeles Dodgers for the National League Championship. In the American League, the New York Yankees take on the LA Angels. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So the debate in Washington continues, as Mark mentioned, over whether or not to deploy more troops to Afghanistan. 8 years in, there's still no defining image of the war, no iconic imagery. Tonight, a Frontline documentary from our partner WGBH premieres on PBS stations. It's called Obama's War, and it captures a fight in the way I guarantee you have not seen before.
Let's go. They're hitting the top of that building.
Fire down.
Hey, I'm moving. Don't shoot me.
Huh? Same spot.
While embedded with a Marine unit in Helmand Province, the filmmakers captured very graphic footage of a U.S. Marine, Lance Corporal Seth Sharp, under fire from the Taliban.
Sharp,
buddy,
come on.
Sharp.
Come on, buddy.
Come on,
Sharp.
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 Come on, Sharp.
Come on, Sharp.
Seth Sharp was killed in action that day. His father, Rick Sharp, joins us now from Adairsville, Georgia. The footage of your son inside this documentary, it is very difficult to watch. Frontline didn't need your permission to air it, but they talked to you, and you didn't have any objections to their using the footage. If they needed your permission, though, in order to air it, would you have given it to them?
Yes.
Why?
Just so the story could be seen of what our men and women are having to do to give us our freedom, the stuff that we take for granted every day. That it's not an easy job that they're having to do. Maybe not as much show Seth's face, but at least they can see the job that they're doing and what they're having to go through, that these are real men and women out there that's putting their life on the line every day.
When I was describing this show to a guy I met in Montclair, New Jersey the other day, he said, oh, they're showing a soldier's death, so it must be anti-war. And I'm just wondering, are you prepared for this idea that by showing your son and in his in his final moments, that people are going to see that as a statement against the war in Afghanistan.
People have their own personal opinions about it. I've heard one or two comments made. How could a family do something like this? Well, it's not anti-war to me. It's showing the job that these men and women are having to do every day. You know, they are putting their life on the line, and that's just one way of people being actually able to see that. It's not a game. This is real life.
Rick Sharp, father of Seth Sharp, he joined us from Adairsville, Georgia. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
We're joined now by Martin Smith, the co-director of Obama's War, and Dan Fung Dennis, the photojournalist who filmed the footage of Marine Lance Corporal Seth Sharp being shot in the neck during a firefight in Helmand Province. Welcome to you both. So, Dan Fung, watching this, it makes you feel like you're standing there amid all the soldiers during this firefight. What did you have to do to get this footage?
I was embedded for 3 weeks with Echo Company, and I simply went with them on this operation. You're with them during the fighting. You're eating and sleeping with them. So just going through the same things that the Marines are going through.
And one of the things that the Marines went through is the death of their comrade, which you filmed. And although your hand never shakes, the camera stays steady, that must have been an extremely moving and traumatic experience for you.
It was a very difficult day. There had been heavy fighting a few hours after we landed, and it was coming from three different directions. So there was a feeling that we were quite isolated and almost surrounded.
And you probably have a different reaction now every time you hear on the news reports that another soldier or two soldiers or someone else has died in Afghanistan.
Right, and the thing is, after 8 years, the names of those killed in action, it's so regular that it doesn't really mean much that anymore. So I'm hoping that this footage will bring the war a little bit closer to home.
You were embedded with them, the soldiers, for quite some time, and you must have established some friendships and some relationships with these soldiers. What was your impression from them? Are the soldiers on the ground, are they feeling missionless? Are they feeling kind of lost? Do they know what they're doing there?
Yes, you get to know them very well. You're going through the same things they're going through. And they understand that their mission is to secure and protect the Afghan population. But that's very difficult for a Marine when you can't tell the difference between an insurgent and a civilian.
We have some actual tape from the documentary in which we hear a soldier's confusion.
Haven't gone where during fighting? Haven't gone where during the fighting?
They haven't gone to, sir.
Gone where? You're not telling me where. Where haven't they gone?
They haven't gone to from here. They haven't gone
from where? Gone where from here? Where?
You can hear that soldier just losing his patience because not even the translator speaks good English.
Yes, it was very frustrating. They tried their best, to make friends, but when they're getting shot at every day, they would have to switch from being this warrior to a statesman on the drop of a dime.
So we're also joined by Martin Smith. There we see the soldiers trying to make friends with the Afghan people, and this is part of General Stanley McChrystal's new purpose, which is to protect the people rather than go after the Taliban. But even that strategy may be changing. If we don't get more troops, we may be doing targeted attacks in Pakistan. What will happen to the Afghani people if we move our troop focus?
I don't think we know what will happen in Afghanistan, but what happened to the policy is an election that was fraudulent. The whole idea of protecting the population, winning hearts and minds, is predicated on the idea that you can then connect them with a legitimate government at their center and take them from their allegiance with the Taliban and connect them with Kabul. Well, when the election itself is fraudulent, the whole thing falls apart.
You know, one of the things, Martin, that strikes me after I finished watching this film was a lot of people feel like the Obama administration is taking way too long to decide on a new strategy. But after watching this film and seeing how impossibly complex this is just for one particular company to accomplish their one particular mission of getting the people to come back to one market in Helmand Province, I can't even imagine how to sort through the entire policy having to do with Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Yeah, I think it's really tough. And the president's showing an enormous amount of flexibility in being willing to go back to square one and rethink this whole thing. The question before him now is, what will 40,000 more troops or 60,000 more troops really accomplish? So he's rethinking the whole thing.
I don't know if 100 more troops could have gotten those people to get back into that marketplace in Helmand Province. I doubt it.
One good translator would have helped.
It's true. Martin Smith's film Obama's War for Frontline is going to air tonight on PBS stations around the country. Also, Dan Fun Dennis, photojournalist, he shot the footage that is so striking at the beginning of Obama's war. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can get a preview of that film. There's 24 minutes of it on our website, thetakeaway.org. I guess the takeaway from the film is, would 40,000 more troops have helped Echo Company getting people back to that market? My guess is no. While you're there, we've got a blog post from our sports correspondent, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, about race, teamwork, and the potential sale of the St. Louis Rams to a group including Rush Limbaugh. That's at thetakeaway.org. And meanwhile, we're asking you if your age has hurt or helped you get a job. And Dawn emails us, my wife and I are both laid off. We have roughly 50 years between us of continuous retail experience and can't find any work to cover our bills. I get the distinct feeling from many employers that they don't believe I'll stay with them once they hire me when something better comes along. I always felt my experience was an asset. So far, it seems to be a liability. What's your experience? Tell us at your story at 8778-MYTAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway. So far, more than 200,000 women have served in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Look, nearly one quarter of all the jobs in the U.S. military are still to this day off limits to women, and that has got to change.
And there are some things that women just do better than men.
What about those that say that women aren't suited for all jobs? They're physically weaker.
How strong do you have to be to pull a trigger?
Women making Afghanistan safer for the guys. It's my kind of story on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, October 13th. I'm Celeste Headlee. John Hockenberry is away for a few days. Coming up this hour, we're going to be talking about women in the military. They're a big part of counterinsurgency operations overseas, especially in Afghanistan. Talk about that. Also, the insurance industry says the Congressional Budget Office is not right. They say they have the real figures about the health care bill, and we'll take a look at the science behind calculating how much health care will cost. But first, Genevieve Chase is a former U.S. Army sergeant in Afghanistan and the founder of American Women Veterans. Good morning, Genevieve. So have we gotten to the place now where opportunities, at least, are equal for men and women in the military?
Actually, no, we're not quite there yet. But as was mentioned just a minute ago, where a quarter percent of the jobs are still off limits to women, what's interesting enough is we are actually doing a lot of those jobs. And I think when we get acknowledgement for the fact that we are participating in those efforts, we'll be headed in the right direction.
Well, it's a really interesting discussion. We're going to talk more about that in a minute with Genevieve Chase. First, everything that you need to know this morning. In the headlines, the Senate Finance Committee is poised to vote on its health care bill. Democrats have the votes to get it through, but they may also get the vote of Republican Senator Olympia Snowe. In economic news, business leader CIT Group just announced this morning that its chairman and CEO Jeffrey Peek will resign at the end of the year. The struggling company is restructuring as it tries to avoid bankruptcy. Overseas Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Moscow right now. She's scheduled to meet with the Russian president any minute. They're expected to talk about a number of topics, including Iran and arms control. In Pakistan, the military launched an airstrike today along the country's main insurgent stronghold near the Afghan border. That may be the first part of a new offensive against insurgents in Pakistan. And if you have money problems, you may have some empathy or not for al-Qaeda. The U.S. Treasury says the terrorist group lacks funding and it's causing the organization's influence to decline. That's a good thing, but the bad news is the Taliban is in much better financial shape because of profits coming from drug money. And in a Los Angeles hospital says it was a computer resetting error that caused 206 patients to receive radiation overdoses. The patients who underwent CT scans received eight times the normal dose. Wall Street mostly flat yesterday. The Dow is going to open up at 98.86. The S&P kicks off at 1076, and the NASDAQ will open up at 21.39. So in this economy, we've learned that it's the youngest and the oldest who are having the hardest time keeping and getting jobs. And we're wondering, what's your story? Has your age helped or hurt you in getting a job?
This is Usha from Detroit. I guess I don't think age is a big factor here because my husband, who is 38 years of age, was let go. So he's neither young nor old, So it's just the economy, I believe.
Let us know your story at 8778-MYTAKE, or you can send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. Today and tomorrow, we're going to be talking about women in the military. There's a lot of things women are not allowed to do in the military. One of them, technically, is they can't engage in direct combat, which would seem to limit them quite a bit. But there are some things that female soldiers do better than men. And it turns out, according to new research, that women are a lot better at counterinsurgency than their male counterparts. Joining me to talk about this is Army Reserve Major Paula Broadwell. She's a researcher at Harvard Center for Public Leadership. Also, retired Army Sergeant Jenna Genevieve Chase is still with us. She's the founder of American Women Veterans. We spoke to her last week as well. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So, Genevieve, you heard the statistic that actually that clip that we used earlier this hour was from G.I. Jane, in which she was saying that 25% of jobs are off limits. And that movie was made in 1997. That's over 10 years ago. And it's still true that 25% of jobs are not available to women in the military.
Well, I don't have that exact statistic, but I know that not a lot has changed since then.
Why not?
Part of it has to do with the fact there are a lot of excuses, I think, that the military and the government and, you know, the Hill uses, and some of that has to do with the fact that we have a lot of important issues going on right now, a lot of important missions, and changing policy is not one of our priorities at this time.
Okay, so Paula Broadwell, you're an Army Reserve major, and you've also done a lot of research on these areas. And I'm wondering, the new research is showing that women are better at counterinsurgency than men are. Why is that? What makes that particular job better suited for women?
Well, I wouldn't say they're better. I'd say they're better at some tasks. And specifically, they're better at the task of engaging other women in the field. If a prime premise of counterinsurgency is winning hearts and minds, then you have to consider that 50% of most populations are women, and especially in conservative societies like Iraq and Afghanistan, dealing with Muslim women is a special case. And for a male soldier to, for example, try to search a woman at a checkpoint is very offensive to the woman in the society in whole. So employing female officers and soldiers in those roles, whether it's searching at checkpoints or searching through mosques in segregated areas where women are located, or even engaging through the female engagement teams that the Marines are running in Afghanistan right now, they're welcomed in the society, and even the Afghan men, for example, view them as less threatening than an American male soldier. So I don't think they're necessarily better, but just better at some roles, and all roles are important in counterinsurgency.
So is it just a truism that the women are better at dealing with the women and the men are better than dealing with the men?
No, I'd say counterinsurgency is different than conventional warfare because we have to use counterintuitive approaches and atypical approaches and think outside of the box. So women have been involved in research and peacekeeping operations and stability operations and other counterinsurgency-type fields of research for a while. So at the strategic level, you're seeing more women involved in that type of oversight. But at the tactical level, they're involved in these roles that are more natural for them in dealing with women, but also backfilling for men just because we have such a high demand on our personnel. So women are out in the field doing convoy patrols. Medics are serving as gunners in Humvees because we need them there because we just don't have enough men, and they're proving themselves. So it's basically been a forced hand, I think.
So, Genevieve Chase, you were a former U.S. Army sergeant. You served, and in 2006, you were working in counterinsurgency in Helmand and Bagram province. Were you treated differently by the Afghan men than the male soldiers?
It ran the gamut. Sometimes I was treated, was very well received by Afghan men, and they were very willing to talk to me, oftentimes even proposing marriage. But a lot of other times we had instances where I was better able to communicate than some of the people that I served alongside, in addition to the fact that at times they did, a few times, they did react with some aggression or hostility. And in those instances, we were able to kind of isolate those people based off of, kind of separate them and kind of see where they aligned in terms of their religion and their beliefs and their culture. And they were a little bit more suspicious to us. because most of the time I was well received.
So was it the kind of thing where you went ahead into the villages ahead of say a unit coming in to prepare the villagers for the soldiers' arrival?
No, we went out on teams and walked around and talked to villagers. We went through bazaars. We stopped at different locations. We were working on civil affairs projects to include a women's prison, which I was allowed access to, as well as a women's center where the men were not.
Paula Broadwell, you were an Army Reserve major, and you served for 5 years in places like Korea, Europe, Africa, Bosnia. Are there different outcomes depending on what culture the woman is deployed in?
Sure, absolutely, but it really comes down to probably the individual leader. If our young junior leaders are educated on how to engage in different cultures, then they're going to perform better. But if we force them into environments where they don't speak the language, they don't have an interpreter, and they're not familiar with the norms of that society, then they're more likely to blunder. So it really comes down to leader development. And what the military is trying to do right now is attract and train adaptive and flexible leaders and prepare them and equip them for the skills and that they'll need in these type of environments. So that's gender neutral. I think both men and women have to adapt to these new environments.
So, Paula, if the women are better, obviously, at handling the women and speaking with the women, does that make a difference when they return back to their unit after having maybe gone into a women's hospital or spoken with the women in the village and they're using, you know, their femininity, that they can form some kind of bond with the Afghan women? Does that then make a difference when they return back to their unit and they're back among their male peers?
I think a lot of the women are respected, and the men in their units respect and recognize the contributions they're making. In fact, many senior male military officers have recognized that we could not have fought these two wars without women. 220,000 women have fought in Iraq and Afghanistan since 9/11. That's 11% of the entire force. And it's interesting, if you do some historical analysis, 7,000 women fought in Vietnam, 33,000 women fought in the first Persian Gulf War, and as I mentioned, 220,000 women have been involved here now. I think that men at all levels recognize the invaluable contributions women make. That's not to dismiss that the challenges that exist for women in the military. There are still cases of rape and sexual harassment, but I think it comes down to educating men on the value of women in their units and then enforcing discipline and standards as far as their behavior.
Well, the 14% of our armed forces is women now. This is compared to 1950, when less than 2% of soldiers were women. And, you know, watching some of the footage coming out of Afghanistan, you've got these soldiers not even sleeping on cots in some of these places. When they're out in the field or out in some of these villages, they're sleeping on the ground, lined up like Vienna sausages on the ground. And that must be difficult when it's co-ed. Genevieve, is that a difficult thing when you're out in the field?
When you're working with a team of guys, you're part of the team, and they see you as a counterpart. And no, it's not difficult. We've had soldiers who did that on a daily basis, did missions outside the wire for weeks and days at a time, who, as you said, slept on the ground right next to their male counterparts. When you build that bond and that camaraderie, it's a very different interaction among your peers.
And you didn't feel nervous, Genevieve Chase. You served in Afghanistan in 2006. You never felt, having heard, as Paula Broadwell was mentioning, there are still some relatively well-publicized incidences of rape and sexual harassment and violence against women in the military. That doesn't make you nervous when you're serving?
No, it doesn't. I it's not something that I think about that's at the forefront of my mind. My job is on there. You know, I'm considering what my mission is, what my responsibilities are, and that's really what's at the forefront of my mind. I slept in a tent with a few hundred infantry guys in Kandahar province during transition. So, you know, during that time, I knew that I had my buddies with me, my teammates with me, and that I would be fine. But you have to be careful and you have to be smart, and we have to also educate our women soldiers and service members and how to take care of themselves, how to look out for themselves, and to make smart choices and smart decisions and to react in a way that they are concerned for their own safety as well as their peers.
Okay, so Paula Broadwell, an Army Reserve major, now that we have seen this new study showing how well women do in counterinsurgency, and knowing that we're going to be using counterinsurgency methods more, are we going to see a larger role for women in the military?
Well, it comes down to recruitment and retention. And as you can imagine, at the mid-career level, when women are in their early 30s and starting families, it's difficult to retain them, especially in this environment where they're deploying 4 and 5 years in a row. It's difficult for men, too, but I think our society places more pressure on women to be the primary caregiver. But if you look at the trends in women's positions in the military and even the percentages you mentioned, when I was born, women made up 1.8% of the military. Now we're 14% in the Army. The Air Force is 20%. Marines are a little less, only 6%. But the Marines are actually employing more women and have opened up new fields, two additional intelligence fields.
So maybe the takeaway here, Paula, is that we're making progress, but it's really slow. That's Paula Broadwell, Army Reserve Major, served 5 years of active duty, also an associate at the Harvard Center for Public Leadership. We also heard from Genevieve Chase, former U.S. Army Sergeant in Afghanistan. We're going to continue this conversation tomorrow about women navigating the military.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now some quick takeouts on stories we're following all this week. To Capitol Hill first, Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is not here this week, filling in our friend Julie Mason. She's the White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. So a quick question first, Julie. This health care bill that the Senate Finance Committee is voting on today, it's expected to pass. After the committee passes it, then what happens?
Well, what happens is they're going to merge that bill with a different Senate bill that came out through the Health Committee. They're going to have to merge those two into one, and then it's going to go to the Senate floor. After that, the House has three different versions of their bill that they have to merge into one, and then we're going to see what happens after that.
So, yeah, exactly. That's really the big fight, isn't it? But since we're talking about fighting, let's talk about Republicans really quickly, because a few days ago, the GOP chairman, Michael Steele, and conservative talk show host Rush Limbaugh, they were in step. They were in agreement. They both said President Obama didn't deserve to win the Nobel Peace Prize. But yesterday, Rush Limbaugh gave a rare television interview, and this is what he said.
The reason I went after him is not because he said those things about me. It's because he's off message. Michael Steele should be out there raising money and planning on ways to get people to vote for Republicans.
That's not Rush Limbaugh going after the president. That's Rush Limbaugh going after GOP Chairman Michael Steele. What happened?
They are so adorable, these two. They crack me up. Well, it's true. And Rush Limbaugh does speak for even a lot of members of Congress who are Republicans who want Michael Steele to get out of policy, to quit sort of messing with what they do and just raise money and just be the party guy and not try to be the policy guy. And it's a real interesting feud to watch, real intra-party feud there.
So is this really what's going on behind the scenes of the GOP? Are they really torn apart between the warring factions there?
Well, it's true. And the problem is they really lack cohesive leadership. Who speaks for the party? That's something we've never figured out. The White House, the Democratic White House, loves when the party fights like that. They love when Rush gets out there in front. He's a real firebrand. And certainly there are a lot of party leaders who don't care for Rush or Michael Steele. So it's a real mess in the party right now. It'll be interesting to see who emerges as sort of the thoughtful leader in the next year or so.
Well, one of those people that doesn't care for the whole fighting is John McCain, who is tight-lipped response to this whole fighting. Who are the other ones who don't particularly want to see this?
Well, again, it's people who want to run for president don't like this. They don't like this kind of like seedy little party feuding. And Tim Pawlenty, some of the people who were a little circumspect in their criticism of President Obama and the Nobel Peace Prize also don't like this sort of Rush Limbaugh Michael Steele feud. So it's a real party division. Very interesting to watch.
Okay, Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. We will keep watching. Now let's go to business with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. Louise, you're actually in D.C. this week, and as we were mentioned a little bit earlier, people are talking about another stimulus package. Yesterday, Larry Summers, he's one of the president's top economic advisors, he talked a little bit about what this new stimulus package might pay for. What did he say about it?
So he said that with unemployment as high as it is, and a lot of economists are expecting it to stay above 9% till the end of next year, he said that justifies more steps from the government, and that we should spend money to create a kind of virtuous circle to spur the economy. But he brought up one thing in particular, which is infrastructure spending, building more bridges, building more roads.
I thought that's what the first one was expected to pay for.
The first one had some of that, but the first one had a lot of money that also went to education, actually. And that was distributed to the states. And Actually, a lot of states cut their own budgets in education, so that money kind of just trickled out into state budgets. But there wasn't as much infrastructure spending as some people had hoped for, and that's what he's saying, you know, you might do now.
So have we spent all the money out of the first stimulus package? Have all those checks been written?
A lot of it's spent. It's not all spent. Really, the problem the Obama administration faces is that a lot of regular people don't see the money really affecting their lives. And we've even got some Democrats, for instance, Chuck Schumer from New York said last week that since most of the first stimulus package hasn't impacted the economy, a second one's not necessary. So it seems to be kind of invisible money. And to some people on Capitol Hill, this is kind of like the kid who lost his allowance money going back to mom and dad for more. So it is controversial, you know.
But who's on board with this? Is this mainly a party line thing?
No, it's mixed across parties because some Democrats think we do need it. But then also you have House Republicans. They just wrote a letter to Obama last week asking for tax cuts for small businesses and saying that the stimulus hasn't reached small businesses. So there's a general feeling down here that more is needed. The question is, should we just extend other programs that are already out there, like the $8,000 homebuyers credit, or should there be a full new batch of money with totally different programs? And that's really what the debate is about, is where do you put the money? How do you spend it rather than do we need it?
Are they thinking of bringing back programs that they actually thought were, I mean, are we going to see a Cash for Clunkers 2?
Well, it's interesting. That's the type of program that Summers said yesterday does seem to work well as a multiplier in the economy. So maybe that, or maybe things similar to it, programs that encourage people to go out and spend money.
Okay, Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner in the New York Times. Louise, have a good time down in Washington, D.C., and I guess we're going to be hearing more about the stimulus package. Can it pass, and what exactly will it pay for? Thanks. As always, our last takeout comes from you, the listener, and you've been taking us and our guests to task, especially John and I, for being too hard on President Obama and his win of the Nobel Peace Prize.
Hi, Alexis from Red Bank. John and Celeste, I think you are continuing negativity surrounding the president's award of the Nobel Peace Prize, and I think it's inappropriate. You know, John, I usually love your commentary, but I just think enough is enough with the negative regarding something really wonderful for a wonderful president.
Lots of responses to the Nobel Peace Prize win, and lots of responses to a blog post by our friend and Morehouse psychology professor David Wall Rice at thetakeaway.org. He wrote that the Nobel Prize was premature, but we should stop bickering about it. And we have emails from Frank. Frank writes, without knowledge of the other candidates, the masses can never determine if there was indeed someone better. I also don't agree with the awarding of the prize, Frank says, as a foreshadowing of future endeavors towards peace. I believe it should be awarded for works done, not works yet to be seen. Kathleen also weighed in at thetakeaway.org. She says, I'm sure the reaction to Martin Luther King receiving the award 45 years ago was similar. King's impact on the world was appreciated the older we get, and it may take 45 more years before we appreciate Obama's impact on the world. And we've been talking about the possibility of political role for the Taliban in Afghanistan's future, and we asked you to weigh in. And Colin from Atlanta called in to defend the president.
The Bush administration had 8 years to deal with the situation in Afghanistan. Now that someone, Obama, is making a concise and decisive decision, it comes under criticism. More troops is not the answer. Just ask the Russians and the British.
Respond, or you can take us to task at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, what is the price tag for the Senate health care bill? We're going to find out what the argument is over how much it's going to cost in just a few moments. But first, here's Mark Garrison with some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes past the hour.
Thank you, Celeste. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Russia right now. She's meeting with President Dmitry Medvedev this hour. Clinton is emphasizing cooperation.
We are different countries. We have different historical experiences, different perspectives. But we are planting those disagreements in a much broader field of cooperation.
Among those disagreements, how tough to be with Iran over its nuclear program. Russia's foreign minister says threatening Iran with strong new sanctions won't work. The U.S. wants to be tougher. The Senate Finance Committee meets in less than half an hour. Today it's expected to approve its health care overhaul. And the Treasury Department says al-Qaeda is short on money. Treasury tracks terror funding and tries to block it. But it also reports the Taliban are rolling in drug profits from Afghanistan. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So as Mark mentioned, the Senate Finance Committee is going to be voting on that health care overhaul bill today. They were waiting to hear from the Congressional Budget Office on exactly how much the health care bill was going to cost. But if you think that number, $829 billion, was the final, settled the argument over that, if that was the final bottom line, you are absolutely wrong, because the American public is still arguing about it. The Finance Committee is going to probably approve the health care bill today. How much is it going to cost you?
I believe it will be cheaper for everyone, because what we're all paying now is pretty expensive. I'm a young person and I pay $200 a month and I don't go see a doctor even once a year.
I think it's too expensive. I think they are giving us the wrong numbers, and I think it should be voted down. I don't even think it should be voted on.
So we're going to look at the exact numbers for health care reform right now with David Herzenhorn, congressional correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. We're also joined by Alice Rivlin. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, former and first Congressional Budget Office director. First of all, Alice, the Congressional Budget Office is, for legislators, the gold standard in accounting for how much these bills cost. Exactly how do they determine the future cost of a bill?
Well, it's a very, very difficult process. Somebody has to do it and give their best judgment. But obviously, nobody can predict the future exactly. What they do is look at the provisions of the bill. In this case, new subsidies for insurance, new requirements that people buy insurance, a new entity called exchanges on which insurance will be bought and sold, and they try to estimate what the cost to the government will be of all of those provisions. Now, they have to look at comparable things that have happened in other places, like Massachusetts, for example, has a similar program, and so there's a little bit of experience there. And they look at other kinds of programs. One big question is always, how many people will actually take up this insurance if it's offered to them? So they have to look at other evidence on that. But in the end, it's a judgmental call. They don't know what's going to happen in the future, but we have to make some estimates of what this will cost to the government, because you can't just throw caution to the winds and say it won't cost anything, or we don't care what it costs.
So David, we also have this new ad campaign. It's paid for by the insurance industries, pretty much, which I assume would make it relatively suspect. But do we know if it's accurate, their numbers that they've come up with? If the CBO is not an exact science, could the insurance industry be right?
Well, I think what we have is a report, right, and we're waiting to see how much they publicize it and if they're going to start an ad campaign opposing the legislation. What we have is an effort by the insurance industry and the their accounting firm to answer a different question, which is, what is this going to cost you or me? What are people going to pay for insurance premiums in the years ahead? And in fact, that's a question that the Congressional Budget Office, which is really expert at this stuff, has said, you know what? That's too complicated for us. We can focus on what this is going to cost the government, but to try and figure out, for each person's individual circumstance, what the insurance premiums are going to be in the future is really, really difficult. And we do know one thing, which is, again, costs are going up. Medical inflation will continue to rise. The question is how fast. Supporters of this bill say they can slow that down a bit for all of us, and it'll work out to be cheaper. Critics say, no, those costs are still going to be out of control. And that's what the insurance industry is trying to suggest here.
But David, doesn't the insurance industry set its own premiums? I mean, aren't the costs, to at least some extent, within their control?
Well, sure, but of course their costs depend on what they have to pay doctors and hospitals and other providers. And the legislation will impose a whole new series of rules, more than any of us have been able to describe in news coverage of it. The common ones are known, right? They would no longer be able to bar coverage based on pre-existing medical conditions. But the law would set minimum benefits levels, which in some cases, my colleague Robert Pear has written about this, those benefit levels would be better, much better than what people often pay for and get now in insurance. So it's very complicated because insurance as we know it will change so much in the years ahead if this bill gets passed.
So, Alice, you also worked in the Clinton administration when they were trying to overhaul health care. The Congressional Budget Office is nonpartisan. And during the Clinton's era, the Clinton administration argued with the CBO about their estimate. They felt that the CBO had come up with the wrong numbers. And so sometimes the CBO office can become part of the political debate. How can we trust who's right and who's wrong if the people on Capitol Hill are arguing amongst themselves?
Well, it's just because they are arguing among themselves that you need the Congressional Budget Office. The Congressional Budget Office has been appointed as the arbiter, the nonpartisan expert. Now, they do the best they can in an uncertain situation, but when everybody is throwing different numbers around and the Congress has to vote on a bill, somebody has to say, this, in our best judgment, as nonpartisan analysts, is what this bill will cost and how much it will save and what the revenues will be. That's CBO's job. Now, when I was Clinton's budget director, of course, I thought the Congress ought to pass the bill that we had proposed. And so we had somewhat different lower cost estimates
than the
CBO did. But we were a party of interest. We wanted this bill to pass. You need the CBO to be, as best they can, the impartial arbiter.
So quickly, David, we pretty much can't trust the numbers coming from anybody who either wants the bill to pass or fail, right?
Well, you got to look at them all carefully, right? I mean, there are also things that are just outside the purview of the CBO, right? It can't tell you whether Americans will do things to make themselves healthier. People
right.
believe that'll happen, but you can't assign any budget savings to that.
Okay, David. Okay, David Harrison-Horn is a congressional correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Alice Rivlin also spoke with us, so she's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute and the first Congressional Budget Office director. Coming up, is it work? Will it even work to ban corner stores in order to get people to eat fresh produce? Los Angeles is thinking about doing that, and we're going to talk about whether or not that is a good way to combat childhood obesity. We're also asking you about your age and your job searches. Have you found that your age has helped you or hindered you as you looked for employment? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. So in all of these strategy sessions that the president is having on Capitol Hill, one thing that supposedly he's asking over and over is, who is our enemy? Who's our main adversary in Afghanistan? And most of his advisors reportedly are telling him that it's Al-Qaeda instead of the Taliban. But now a senior U.S. government official says Al-Qaeda, it may be on the downward slide. David Cohen, who monitors terrorist funding at the U.S. Treasury Department, said in a speech last night that Al-Qaeda's influence is waning because they're running out of money. He said the U.S. and its allies had successfully cut off the group's sources of funding by targeting donors. To get an expert assessment of this, we're joined from London by Loretta Napoleoni, an expert on international terrorist financing, author of Rogue Economics. So, Loretta, is David Cohen correct when he says that Al-Qaeda is running out of funds?
Yes, he is. We have known this for the last 12 months. In fact, Al-Qaeda has launched three messages in the last 6 months asking for money from, you know, the network of its traditional sponsors.
Is this all due? I mean, we had reports after 9/11 that Al-Qaeda was very well funded, extremely well healed. Is this mean that the efforts of the U.S. and its allies has worked to cut off funding?
Well, I think the situation that we are facing today is the result, of course, of the invasion of Afghanistan, the fact that Al-Qaeda has been forced into a region, Waziristan, where virtually it is prisoners. But also, I would say, it is related to the transition of the Taliban, which are not anymore an army that is fighting Al-Qaeda war, but it is very much a narco-traffickers kind of militia.
So how does this change the strategy possibly in Afghanistan? Does this mean we need to view Al-Qaeda as less of a threat and focus more on the Taliban?
Yes, I think we should look at the Taliban as an army that wants to gain control of the territory in order to turn the region into a narco state. That means that they have potentially many more allies than they had before. We see, for example, the warlords, but also the poppy growers. So the situation is actually, I would say, more serious on the ground than it was before 9/11.
Well, so you're talking about warriors, narco warriors. Are you saying that some of the people fighting for the Taliban are maybe fighting for control of the drug trade rather than for some of the ideological or religious regions that the Taliban is normally associated with?
Yeah, the Taliban are fighting more and more to control the narco trade. This is the first time that the Taliban actually have a source of income which is independent from funding coming either from Al-Qaeda or coming from the ISI in Pakistan, and they like the idea. They also like the idea that through this kind of income, they can control the territory and go back to what it was Afghanistan before 9/11.
It seems to me that it would be very difficult, though, to cut off funding to the Taliban if they're earning them themselves through poppy growing.
Yes, I think this is why we need to change the strategy. I mean, fighting this war in Afghanistan may be not the best option. Maybe we have to fight the war somewhere else, you know, where, you know, the Taliban are raising the money, which is, of course, in the streets of our city where they are selling the heroin that is supporting this army, this new army of Taliban.
Okay, Loretta Napoleoni, an expert on international terrorist financing, author of the book Rogue Economics. She's responding to a word from David Cohen, who monitors terrorist funding at the U.S. Treasury Department. Good morning. This is actually the Takeaway with Jess Celeste Headley today. John Hockenberry is away for a few days. Coming up, how much does a convenience store buying Slurpees and Slim Jims at the corner store, how much does that impact childhood obesity? L.A. thinks it impacts it a lot, and they might ban new corner stores, which I'm going to talk about that in a minute. We're also asking you about your age and how it affects your job search. We have new studies showing that young people are have as low a rate of employment as they have since 1948. Tell us your story. Has your age hurt or helped you when you looked for a job at 8778-MYTAKE, or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, Mark Garrison is here with a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour.
Thank you, Celeste. The Senate Finance Committee meets in about 15 minutes. Today, the committee votes on its health care overhaul. Not to spoil the surprise, but senators will approve it. The Dems have the votes. What to watch is whether Republican Senator Olympia Snowe joins them. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Russia right now talking arms control and Iran's nuclear program. She just wrapped a meeting with President Dmitry Medvedev. Some major business news just in last hour. The chief of CIT is resigning. The troubled business-to-business lender has been trying to stay out of bankruptcy. And looking ahead to later this week, baseball's league championships are now set. The Philadelphia Phillies won last night, so they face the Dodgers for the National League Championship. In the American League, the New York Yankees take on the LA Angels. Those are some of the stories we're following.
Well, down at the corner grocery store, there's not a lot of fresh produce. And in Los Angeles, they think that all those corner grocery stores is what's contributing, at least, to the obesity problem there. The LA City Council is considering a proposal that would ban any new corner stores in South Los Angeles, and it's not making convenience store owners like Joe Bezerra very happy.
I think this is ridiculous what they are trying to do. The government always tries to do things on the wrong way. If they want to do anything to help the obese people, they should make a campaign on education, teach them how to eat and drink accordingly.
Does a campaign of education actually help? We're going to talk more about a study that said that convenience stores could contribute to childhood obesity. The co-author was Dr. Deborah Cohen. She's a senior national scientist at RAND Corporation. It's a research nonprofit and co-author of a public health obesity study out in the journal Health Affairs last week. That's what's caused these proposals from the LA City Council. We're joined by two other guests as well. Lark Galloway-Gilliam is the Executive Director of Community Health Councils, and Jeff Leonard, spokesperson for the National Association of Convenience Stores. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
So,
good morning.
Deborah, let's start with you. Your study basically shows that people consume more calories, I guess, from convenience stores than they do at, say, McDonald's or Taco Bell. But you don't suggest in your report that the convenience stores actually be closed. Why not?
First of all, the reason why we have this obesity epidemic in general is that people are just have easy access to too much food with, you know, too high calories and too few nutrients. And, you know, food is available in so many places. It's not just fast food restaurants and convenience stores, but also businesses that, you know, their main businesses in food are also selling food, like bookstores, hardware stores. There's also, you know, billboards and posters, and there's just so many cues to eat that actually artificially stimulate people to feel hungry. And that's the problem, is that, you know, we just have too many food cues that make us hungry and make us eat too much. People were designed to overeat.
That's not a very good takeaway there. Lark Galloway-Gilliam, you're the executive director of Community Health Councils. So in many of these lower-income areas, especially urban areas, they can't get grocery stores to come in. So I'm wondering, why should we close convenience stores when in many places that's the only access to groceries that people have?
Exactly. Well, I don't think that the proposal that the city council is looking at attempts to close convenience stores. It really is about being more strategic about where we allow these stores to be placed in the future. It doesn't impact any of the current stores. It's about saying, how many do we need, and can we use that land more strategically to actually try to begin to a campaign to bring grocery stores in and to make sure that there's not a convenience store or fast food outlet on every corner where we find a school, for example. So it's really not about closing stores, as thinking about more strategically where we allow them to be located.
But can we bring the grocery stores with fresh produce and delis? Can we bring those into these areas where they've been resistant to building facilities before?
I think so. We've seen the Tesco Fresh and Easy store now starting to come into these areas. We see smaller independent chains. I think what's incumbent upon our elected officials is to be more aggressive about recruiting those stores into these communities.
So, Jeff Leonard, you're the spokesperson for the National Association of Convenience Stores, and convenience stores are kind of getting painted as the bad guys here. But if convenience stores offered fresh produce, would people buy them at a corner store?
That's the big question, and I apologize, I'm not in the dentist's office. They decided to work right outside my office right now. Tesco's nice Fresh and Easy is a good example. They lost over $200 million last year. They're looking at long-term, but they have the deep pockets to do that. And the corner store with one store may not have those options, and you really need to deliver what people will buy today, not what you hope they'll buy tomorrow. That's the big challenge in all this.
Are you concerned, though, about this new research showing that convenience stores are actually contributing to childhood obesity?
I think anybody should be concerned that childhood obesity is a problem now. I think the report also cited TV as a big example. That's not to deflect away from the problem, but in some of the more metro areas, they rely on the corner store. They aren't able to go to, you know, the big box and buy the 5 gallons of mayonnaise or whatever. They buy food there every day, and I think looking at the numbers, the metrics, the density is about 50 stores per 100,000 people. That's really about the density nationwide. When you look at West LA, it's much less because they probably do have those big box options. So the convenience store model works in Japan. There's not obesity there. It's obviously a bigger problem than just the stores, but the stores certainly want to be part of the solution.
So, Deborah Cohen, in your research, you talk about stopping the appeal of the foods that they'd get, say, Ruffles or Slim Jims that you get at, say, a corner store, and not stopping the places that sell them. We've seen other big health initiatives, like trying to get people to stop smoking. Have we learned anything from, say, these past health initiatives that might help us in battling obesity?
Yeah, I think the tobacco campaigns were a really great example of the direction that we need to go in for controlling obesity. In tobacco, they had a lot of counter-advertising messages which pointed out, how tobacco was bad and, you know, the negative consequences of tobacco. And we need those campaigns against the kinds of foods that are associated with obesity, like sugar-sweetened beverages, cookies, candies, sweetened baked goods, but especially sugar-sweetened beverages. And I think the convenience stores are really an example of one of the problems. You know, if you want a drink, you can only get extra large sizes in convenience stores. You know, something that's a drink that's like 300-400 calories. So, you know, having a counter message at the time people might be making a decision can help them make a wiser decision. Otherwise, people are automatically going to be more likely to choose something high in sugar and fat, which is, you know, we're designed to respond to those ingredients in a much stronger way.
Okay, so quickly, Lark Galloway-Gilliam, you're the executive director of community health councils. Are not the residents of these areas who feel like they are underserved by grocery stores, if you limit the number of convenience stores that come in, will they not be unhappy?
I don't think so, because, I mean, I think you have to go in and look at what's available in the convenience stores. Typically, that's not where people are going to get all of their food needs. Clearly, it's a place that provides some ready access to household supplies and the big gulps and the like. But there's still a tremendous need in our community for places where you can get fresh meat and fresh vegetables. And so I think if we can offer that, I think we'll have a much healthier and happier community.
That's Lark Galloway-Gilliam, Executive Director of Community Health Councils. We also spoke with Jeff Leonard, spokesperson for the National Association of Convenience Stores, and Dr. Deborah Cohen, Senior National Scientist at the RAND Corporation. She also co-authored a study that's causing the LA City Council to try to limit new convenience stores. If you want to weigh in on that or anything else that you hear, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. It doesn't matter what you have to say.
I forgot what I was calling about.
We still want to hear from you, and if you forget what you're going to call about, you can always call us back at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're asking you for your stories about age and how has it hurt or helped your job search. Let us know how it has helped you. We got one email where Allie said, I am a 24-year-old master's student pursuing a degree in education policy at NYU. Turns out I'm too inexperienced and too expensive to be hired. Go figure. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway. Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.